Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On this Politics Monday, a look at the perfect distillation of the promise and peril of modern American democracy. Hyperpartisanship, gerrymandering, and dissatisfaction among voters with the two-party system. We don't have to look far for all this because all of it comes into sharp focus here in North Carolina. We are the most purple of purple states, though it may not seem so at first blush. Yes, we have two Republican United States senators. Yes, the legislature is controlled by Republicans. Yes, congressional and other districts have been drawn in such a way that it is difficult, if not impossible, for Democrats to win in parts of the state. And yet, the electorate is almost evenly divided between those who identify as Democrat and those who call themselves Republicans. So, if we're purple, how did we get so red? Political scientist Dr. Chris Cooper, director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University, offers up his take on all of this in his new book, Anatomy of a Purple State, North Carolina Politics Primer, and he joins us for the hour from a hotel room somewhere in Chapel Hill. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So let's start with how things are in the mountains, because Western Carolina University is located in Cullowhee. That's about 50 miles west of Asheville in the Great Smoky Mountain region. Just like other sections of the mountains, I'm sure you were impacted by Hurricane Helene last weekend. So how bad are things, or how good are things in your situation?
Yeah, I mean, my personal situation, I feel very fortunate. The town of Silva, where I live, we did have some flooding, but it wasn't nearly as major as in other parts of the region. The wind wasn't quite as bad as we thought it was going to be. It seems to be, generally speaking, the farther west you got, kind of the better it was. But that is not true for many of our neighbors. There are parts of Jackson County and the Cashers area, the southern part of the county, that got just absolutely devastated. Haywood County, of course, has parts. And then Buncombe County, Henderson County, McDowell, Watauga, those places are just decimated. We have family in Asheville, and I'm not sure when they'll be able to get back home, when they can be able to have drinkable water. And then I drove through on the way to Chapel Hill through Old Fort and some of these other places that just, you can't imagine the scar on the landscape that exists right now and how long it's going to be there.
You were telling me before we started that you were driving a relative to South Carolina and had to go and pick them up, and parts of towns are simply not there anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, anything that was low-lying, anything close to a river in Buncombe County off of Swannanoa River Road just isn't really there anymore. I mean, it is destruction and devastation like you're used to seeing on TV from the coast. You're used to seeing it on TV, you know, in Florida, perhaps. You're not used to seeing this kind of devastation in the mountains. It is widespread, and it's going to take, you know, years, not weeks or months, I think, for real recovery.
And I think that people don't understand the difference necessarily, because we don't think about it much, between what the recovery efforts along coastal areas, which are flat. The mountains are, they're mountainous, and they're rugged, and they're forested, so it's making things much more difficult. And you were talking before we went on the air about the enormous amount of disinformation that is floating around out there about FEMA and about recovery efforts, about what can and cannot be done, and how you're going to be compensated, etc., much of which is not coming from this country, you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think a lot of this is not coming from this country. It is being echoed by some people in this country, right? But I think it is originating elsewhere. And it is incredibly disturbing. I mean, we do have FEMA that's there. We do have government agencies that are helping, that are working. I mean, I've laid my own eyes on them, right? You can see convoys coming into Western North Carolina. So the notion that there's nobody there to help other than private citizens and to some degree vigilantes is just factually incorrect. And I was very pleased to see, heartened to see Kevin Corbin, for example, who's a Republican who represents the 50th Senate District in North Carolina, put on Facebook and just say, look, this is all garbage. This is all nonsense. And it's getting in the way of those of us who are trying to do real work for the people of Western North Carolina. So it makes me feel somewhat good that we're seeing folks from both sides of the aisle say, this is garbage. This is misinformation. Ignore it.
Putting your political science hat back on for a moment, although the upcoming election is the last thing on the people's minds up there trying to recover from this, people who lost family members, people who lost businesses and homes and other property, they're not thinking about this. But there is an election coming in less than 30 days, and some say that many of the worst affected areas in the mountains from this storm were red areas, areas in which the people there were more likely to vote for Donald Trump than perhaps Kamala Harris. Do you think that's accurate? And do you think this disaster will have any meaningful, measurable impact on the outcome of this election in North Carolina and determine whether or not it goes for Trump or Harris?
I think it might, and I'm happy to talk about that. And I think first, the bigger concerns I have are the election administration piece, right? So I think you said at the outset, we're about 30 days from the election, and that is true. We're about 30 days from election day.
Right.
But look, we're already casting ballots in the state of North Carolina. There are people's mail ballots that were already being delivered. And, you know, election workers are just like anybody else. They might have lost their house too. So let's sort of think of a couple of examples that I think are very real. Henderson County only has one early voting location for the entire county. Now, it probably could be difficult for some folks to get there under normal times, but given what's happening now, it may be downright impossible to get there. We also have staffing issues in many of these places. You know, let's say Jane Doe and John Smith are going to work the polls the second Tuesday of early voting. Well, they may not be in town anymore. They may not have a home anymore. They're not going to be working those polls. So these election administrators who are already working overtime and then some are going to have to do even more. And I think what we need to do is to remember that we do have one election director per county. They know their county better than anybody else. This is a time we really need to be giving discretion to local election officials throughout the Western counties. They're the ones who know exactly where the problems are and where the problems aren't. So that's the administration piece.
Getting information out to where to come to vote in under these extraordinary circumstances is going to be perhaps impossible because people don't have access to cell phones. They don't have access to internet. How are they going to do it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's very difficult. You're seeing all around the West signs put up like it's, you know, very old school. So you come to the main part of town and you'll see signs that will announce things. We certainly had that in Jackson County announcing the closure of Western Carolina University for a few days during the storm. So I don't know. I think it's a real challenge. I also think we need to remember politicians aren't going to be communicating as many messages. And look, I don't want to get some of these messages either, right? They're hyperpartisan, they're annoying, but politicians remind us to vote, right? Campaigns remind us to vote. Campaigns are about mobilization. And Chuck Edwards, for example, who is the member of Congress in the 11th Congressional District, smartly said, I'm just suspending my campaign for a little while. Well, those are messages that are not going out to voters to remind them to vote. Again, I think that was a rational and a good decision, but it has some effects as well.
Well, you're here. Dr. Chris Cooper is with us to talk about his new book, Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina politics primer. So let's get into it. You say that North Carolinians are among the most moderate voters in the country. That may surprise a lot of people. You point out that Charlotte and Wake County are areas in which the bulk of the population is to the left and may even be close to the kind of voters that reside in the San Francisco Bay Area. I find that difficult to believe, but okay, if you say so, I'll take your word for it. But the rural areas are red, and they kind of balance each other out. So why do we appear to be so red?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, right? And so when I say we're a purple state, obviously I don't mean we've got 7.5 million purple voters running around the state. I mean, we have about half of them that are to the right, about half to the left, and we average to something that looks pretty purple by really any metric we can come up with. So why do we look so red? I think part of it is that we tend to overread the red-blue map, right? So if you're, for example, in the 2020 election, of course, we voted for Donald Trump, gave all of our electoral college votes to Trump for president, but of every state that he won, his margin was the smallest in North Carolina of any of them, right? So if you're going to define what is purple, wouldn't you expect it to be right on that razor's edge between red and blue? And that's where we've been for a number of cycles. In 2008, the last time we voted for a Democrat for president, everybody said, well, North Carolina's gone blue. No, of every state that Obama won, his margin was the smallest in North Carolina of any of them. 2012, Romney, red, same thing, right? The same basic story has been playing out. So I think it's because we overread this red-blue map combined with a couple of facts about politics. One is the Republicans have done a better job turning out voters in every cycle since 2008. And then, of course, when it comes to many of our district lines, both the way people tend to settle and gerrymandering have obviously contributed to this sort of red hue that that it looks like we have from afar.
So we are a swing state, a two-party state, a moderate state, a competitive state, a purple state. Are those terms all interchangeable, and are they all true?
You know, it's interesting, right? The one that's probably the least true is swing, because we haven't really swung, right? We're a purple state that hasn't swung to the Democrats since 2008, right? So my argument is that we're sitting right in the middle. And so it is absolutely purple. It is absolutely battleground. It is absolutely up for grabs. But if you look at recent history, obviously there hasn't been as much swinging as there has been in some other places.
So if we're evenly, kind of evenly divided between red and blue, making us purple and making us fairly consistent, that's what I'm hearing you say in terms of the way things go. Let's talk about something that's, to me, unexplainable. Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson came out of nowhere politically to get the position that he now holds as lieutenant governor. He's made along the ways, even before he was in politics, some highly controversial, even repugnant comments, and yet he is the GOP candidate for governor, despite the allegations that CNN has recently come up with. They're sticking with him. Michelle Morrow, who also has made some controversial and sometimes repugnant statements about politicians on the other side of the aisle, is a serious candidate, Republican candidate for state superintendent of public instruction, and she defeated the moderate Republican incumbent in the primary for the right to run in that race. So how do you explain the success of Robinson? Why does North Carolina consistently choose the Republican candidate for president and sometimes a Democratic governor outside of Barack Obama's election?
So as far as Robinson and Morrow and why don't we throw Madison Cawthorn in there for fun as well? I think the answer is because primaries are where the action is in American politics, right? Particularly in districts, which we'll talk about Cawthorn later. But with Robinson, it doesn't matter to some degree that we are a purple state for him to win a primary. Same thing with Michelle Morrow, right? You're getting very, very, very small electorates of one particular party. In the case of Cawthorn, for example, he didn't even win the first primary. He had to go to a second primary or runoff before he was able to pull off a victory. So it isn't really the voice of the people that's deciding the primary. It's a voice of the primary voter, which is very different. So how do they do well in the general, right, is the next logical question. And I think the answer is you can put essentially any candidate up in a purple state, and they're going to start with 45% of the vote regardless, just because they happen to have an R and D next to their name. So if you're a Republican voter, let's say you like Tom Tillis, you're a more moderate Republican voter, ain't wild about Michelle Morrow, but at the same time, you probably like her policies better than Beau Green, the Democratic opponent. So you sort of hold your nose and you vote for the person whose opinions align with you more. It's driven by the primary. That's the agenda setter.
We could maybe spend some time talking about that and how that primary, which focuses people on the far right and the far left, affects the general. And when we come back with Dr. Chris Cooper in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Chris Cooper, our guest. He's professor of political science and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University, and also the author of a new book called Anatomy of a Purple State, Why That Would Be Us, a North Carolina politics primer. He joins us this morning from somewhere in Chapel Hill. We've talked about this in the past, and you just brought this up, that you can... The primaries obviously determine the candidates for each party in the general election, and the primaries tend to focus on candidates that play to the base, whether they're far right or they're far left, which is how you end up with candidates like Mark Robinson and Michelle Morrow, who beat out a moderate Republican incumbent in the primary, Catherine Truitt, for state superintendent of education or public instruction. But then the general election comes along, and you have this, as you talk about in the book, this almost even divide between Republicans and Democrats and a bunch of people in the middle who call themselves independents. Do you shoot yourself in the foot, whether you're to the left or to the right, by nominating somebody to the extremes in the primary and putting them up in the general in a state like this?
To some degree... Yeah, and to some degree, 2024 is going to be a great test of this, right? I mean, whether you love or don't love Michelle Morrow and Mark Robinson, I don't think anybody would describe them as moderate. So I think we have a great test case here. And I think to get the independent, the small number of truly independent swing voters, yes, it's a problem. But what those candidates often do is they mobilize the base, right? So the way that the Republicans have been doing better in North Carolina in some of these electoral outcomes, they just win by small margins, but they win consistently, is about turnout, right? It's about mobilization. And so those kind of candidates, unless perhaps you get to a Mark Robinson situation, haven't depressed turnout. They've actually done quite the opposite. And I think that's one reason why we've got these sort of puzzling outcomes that you might see from afar.
One of our listeners, Mike, has emailed us the question that kind of plays into this. He wants to know, aren't there a lot of registered independent voters in North Carolina that tend to lean right? And does that not account for a lot of the dominance of Republicans?
It does to some degree, right? So we have, of course, registered unaffiliated voters, I think is what Mike's talking about there. That's not independent, right? We used to have a category called independent, and that's now gone. So it's unaffiliated. That, of course, is the largest number of registered voters in the state of North Carolina. As far as them leaning right or leaning left, to some degree, they follow the county they're in. So if grab Mecklenburg County, for example, and unaffiliated voters in MEC tend to lean to the left. And unaffiliated voters in Swain County, for example, tend to lean towards the right. And we actually see a surprising amount of movement between political party primaries among these unaffiliated voters. So some work I've done with Michael Bitzer and Whitney Ross Manzo and Susan Roberts, we found that about 46% of these unaffiliated voters who do vote actually switch primaries, right? Some sense that they might really be these kind of unmoored swing voters. The other thing to remember for Mike and everybody else about unaffiliated voters is they don't tend to vote as often. So we can say, and I do talk in the book about how it's the largest group of registered voters in the state. It's not the largest group of voters in the state of North Carolina.
We have a lot of gerrymandering going on in this state. Democrats held the legislature for over 100 years. When they were in power, they did much of what the Republicans are doing now in terms of gerrymandering in order to cement themselves into that power. Somehow, Republicans were able to use their wedge and get them out, and now they're making themselves cemented in. Modern technology has actually given them, and we've talked about this in the past, a lot more power than their predecessors because they can surgically target certain areas to make sure they stay Republican and not Democrat. If we are a purple state, why haven't moderate voters demanded an end to this? And if that doesn't happen, can we really expect any change in more accurately representing the ideals of voters in North Carolina?
Yeah, I think why haven't they demanded the change? Partially because it's hard to imagine how they would, right? We don't have initiatives in this state. I think if we did have an initiative process, if the people could bring a petition that would then go to a vote of the people, we probably would have had one already about some sort of independent redistricting commission. Other states have done this. It tends to work pretty well. There's some exceptions to that. So I think the public opinion would say, yeah, nobody really likes gerrymandering, right? If you say gerrymandering, good or bad, Not many people are going to say this is a positive thing for democracy, but there's not a great way for the people to be able to exercise that choice in a state without any sort of direct democracy. And so we're kind of stuck with this problem. And it is a, I think, as you noted, this is a people in power problem. This is the Democrats actually shut the Republicans out of Congress in the state of North Carolina in the 1940s completely. Like, there's like no Republicans in the whole state. And they did that by connecting the western part of the state across to the middle of the state. Republicans now do it with, obviously, as you said, surgical precision, also aided by computers, but also aided by increasingly consistent voting patterns, right? So if you drive into West Asheville, it isn't hard to figure out people probably lean a little bit left. And so if you're trying to draw lines, you don't really need as much information as you did before, and our technology is better. So I think it's a sort of the perfect storm that's given us this kind of mess that we have today.
You wrote an opinion piece for the Salisbury Post, and in it you said, you talked about how before a single vote is cast, we know the outcome in most states, and that, quote, polarization aided by strategic gerrymandering also means that fewer than 10% of congressional elections are truly competitive, with state legislatures not being much different. Have we already destroyed democracy? And if not, how much longer can it last under conditions like this?
Yeah, it's great. I don't think it's an either or, right? I don't think it's a light switch. We say we either have democracy or we don't have democracy, right? It is a scale, it's a spectrum. And I think it is being challenged in a lot of ways in our state and in some other states by gerrymandering and lots of other problems. I mean, we have in our state with these new congress. So right now we have, of course, 7-7, right? 7 Democrats, 7 Republicans in the state of North Carolina. We're right. Going to get 10 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and then a big question mark in the northeastern corner of the state in Congressional District 1. So we've got two-party competition in a lot of these places. The Democrats did a much better job, and the Republicans, of running people in lots of districts for our General Assembly. But for the vast majority, we still know what's going to happen beforehand. Again, partly because of polarization and where we live, partly because of gerrymandering, 1+1 equals this kind of mess we have today.
We have a 7-7 congressional delegation now because the courts got involved. We're going to have, as you say, a different makeup because they redrew the maps this time around. But you still say that in spite of the fact that many states are predetermined, you can tell what the outcome is going to be before it even starts, we're not that way. We're on the short list of competitive purple states where the outcomes are not predetermined. How can that be when we have this new split in the congressional delegation that's coming up in January?
That's a great question. I think it depends on whether you're talking about districts or other kinds of at-large elections. So let's grab Council of State for a good example of that, right? We have this pretty large Council of State. We have 10 folks, right? The governor, lieutenant governor, folks know those people, but we've got labor, we have education, as we've already talked about. We've got Secretary of State, auditor, treasurer, and on down the line. Those folks run on partisan tickets statewide. Currently, we have 4 Democrats and 6 Republicans, right? Certainly not a blue state by anybody's, you know, estimation, but 4 out of 10, I think, puts us somewhere in this purple place. And then to put an even finer point on that and kind of how much we stand out as purple in the South, if you add up all of the Council of State elections in the entire United States South, you know how many Democrats were actually elected to those seats? 4. All 4 are in the state of North Carolina. So if you're looking for somewhere where the Democrats actually have a chance of victory in the South, you could do a lot worse than a look at North Carolina.
Is that why you say we are constantly competitive? Or is there more to it than that?
I think that's part of it, right? I think there's a lot of evidence that we are constantly or consistently competitive. And the hard thing to wrap our head around, I think, is that if you try to say, okay, why do we have such nasty, no holds barred, you know, knives out politics? And the answer is, I believe, because we are so competitive. So if you're in Oklahoma and you're a Republican, you can slow roll this thing, right? You can take all the time you want because you're going to be in charge for a long time. You're the Democrats in California. No need to act with haste. You're in charge in the state of North Carolina. You might not be in charge very soon. So you have to act quickly. You have to act with knives out kind of politics. So what makes us purple is exactly what makes us polarized and exactly what makes the politics here so no holds barred.
And I guess that explains why Republicans have been so hyperactive when it comes to gerrymandering. They got power after 100 years of being out in the wilderness, and by God, they're going to hang on to it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And look, they said that. They were very clear. They said, we were shut out of decision-making in this state for 100 years. Now let's watch what happens when we have it. And we have, and they were right.
Because we are this so-called swing state, we're getting a lot of attention in the presidential race, but we've been getting that attention for a while. In your introduction, you bring up both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. You quote the Times, tracing North Carolina's decline from a beacon of farsightedness in the South to a demolition derby, and blaming the Republican General Assembly for, quote, tearing down years of progress in public education, tax policy, racial equality in the courtroom, and access to the ballot. Meanwhile, you also quote the Wall Street Journal, asking why liberals here are so angry and pointing out that Republican policies to spur growth and job creation. You say that the journal gives the impression that the protests coming from the left are nothing more than well-funded distractions from the real work of governing. Which publication has it correct? And in voters' minds, which of those opinions do most of them hold?
That's a great question. I don't think either one of them has it completely correct. I'm sure you'd be shocked that I'm saying that. But I mean, I think it to me, this illustrates a couple of things about North Carolina politics. One, just the fact that the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times are weighing in on North Carolina politics shows just how nationalized our politics are, just how critical, right? I mean, just the notion that they would think that readership of the Times, of the Wall Street Journal, cares about the inner workings in North Carolina shows, again, the prominence and the nationalization of our politics. And then I think the back and forth there just shows how nasty it is. As far as where most people in the state fall, I think it is probably honestly somewhere near the middle. And I think that's why. I think if I said 75% agree with the Times or 75% agree with the Wall Street Journal, then we'd see very different election outcomes than the ones that we see.
You talked a moment ago about how competitive we are and why, because we're on this razor's edge. And you refer to a fellow political scientist, Francis Lee, who calls this insecure majorities. Is that healthy or is it unhealthy to have these the chance that you might lose power, so you'd better be aggressive about wielding it while you have it? Is that healthy or is it not healthy?
I don't think it's healthy at all, right? I mean, and I don't think anybody would look at that and say, gee, that's a positive. At the same time, one party holding power for decades and decades and decades isn't particularly healthy either, right? I mean, we want some level of competition, but nothing comes without a cost. And I think this is the cost that we're getting of some competition. I think we need to, as a state, regardless of whether you're lean left or lean right, be thinking about what we can do institutionally to try to mitigate some of the negative consequences of being so competitive, right? We have an overwhelmingly powerful General Assembly, an incredibly weak governor. Most folks don't know that, right? So if you split your ticket between the General Assembly and the governor, you may be thinking, hey, look, I'm getting power that's somewhere in the middle. The reality is the governor of our state has the least power of any governor of any state in the United States. It's 50 out of 50, right? So I think it's about thinking through the institutions we have, why they're set up the way they are.
Has that always been the case? Was it set up in the state constitution for the governor's office to be so weak? And when it was set up, who was in power?
Yeah, it was set up to be very weak, right? We've had three constitutions in the state of North Carolina.
Right.
They have some differences. All three say we're a legislature first state. The governor has the least power. And just the most obvious or kind of finest example of that is the veto power. We were the last state in the country to give the governor the veto power. When we did give the governor the veto power, we made it very, very weak. And then the grand stroke of irony in North Carolina politics, the person who sponsored the bill to give the governor finally the weak veto power was a state senator from Nash County named Roy Cooper, who would later be frustrated by his inability to be able to use the veto more often on things like gerrymandering.
And of course, with supermajority, it's almost a foregone conclusion that any veto will be overridden by the legislature. Tip O'Neill once said all politics is local, but increasingly our political conversations have centered on national politics, and that is particularly true during presidential election cycles. But you point out that it is, quote, Raleigh, not Washington, that is home to the people who manipulate the key levers of power that determine abortion rights, state tax rates, higher education funding, Medicaid expansion, marijuana laws, curriculum and instruction in high schools, economic development incentives, and a host of other issues. You think most people understand that? Because we don't really talk about state politics much. We talk about the presidential race.
Yeah, absolutely. It's critical. And it's one reason that I wanted to write this book, right? Is that we are just in the volume is so high in national politics, and the amount we can do to affect that is so small. Whereas state politics, the volume is much lower, but that's really where we can actually have some sort of impact. So I think the world would be way better off if more people could identify Tim Moore than Madison Cawthorn, if more people knew who Robert Reeves was than Hakeem Jeffries, right? That state politics is really where the action is in American politics. You can like that or dislike that, but it's just the facts. Yet we continue to be dominated by presidential politics. Even when we say, who's going to win the election? People ask me a lot, right? I go to the store. Somebody says, Chris, who's going to win the election? One, I don't know. But two, I know they're asking me a question about the presidency. Nobody's ever asked that question, and they're really fired up to know about the Jackson County Commission race. But they should be, or their state legislative race.
But is that partly because we are so gerrymandered, you can't do anything about the makeup of the legislature, and they have all the levers of power. You can vote for the governor. He's the one guy that we vote state, well, not the one guy, but he's one of the people that we vote statewide for. But the legislature, which is district by district, has all the power, and they're gerrymandered in. So is that why we don't talk about it? There's no point.
I don't think that's it. All right. So if that were the case, then let's grab Lindsey Prather's district, which is House District 115 in Buncombe County. That is an incredibly competitive district, right? It's drawn to be competitive now. It wasn't competitive. It is now. Lindsey Prather is a Democratic incumbent. Ruth Smith is a well-financed Republican, quality Republican challenger. They're running against each other. I don't know who's going to win that race. And I bet you if you were to survey the people in that district versus the ones right next to them where the Democrats are going to win by huge margins, you wouldn't find any more engagement in the election in that competitive district.
When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the impact of a lack of female representation. And that's not just unique to North Carolina. It's unique. It's part of the whole political makeup around the country, but it is particularly stark here. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about, again, the urban-rural divide. And that biggest block of voters out there who are neither red nor blue, or so they say, are they purple or are they something else? Those independents, those unaffiliated voters. Chris Cooper is our guest. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University, our guest today. He has a brand new book out called Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. He wrote the book because a journalist once asked him, new to politics in North Carolina, what should I read? What books should I read to really get a handle on what I'm about to cover? And you couldn't come up with any answers because they were all old, 15, 20, 25 years old. So you wrote this book. I want to come back to what we were talking about before the break. And it's a big section of your book entitled First Among Equals, the North Carolina General Assembly. We have had a strong legislative branch and a weak governor by design in the Constitution for a very long time. But now conservatives around the country have been promoting this idea of the legislature being the leading branch. Is this likely to get stronger with time as long as Republicans hold those seats?
It's hard to imagine it becoming much stronger, right? I mean, our General Assembly has, I mean, to say it's the lion's share of power is an understatement. So I don't know that it's going to increase much more. I think the body itself, the legislature itself, has almost done a good job of not just self-preservation, but self-expansion. It's hard to imagine how our governor could be much weaker. The courts obviously have a good bit of power, and I think that's one place where perhaps somebody can hone in a little bit on legislative power. But I don't see much change coming there. I think this is kind of where we're going to be as a state for a while.
And we have this weak governor system. It's not just the legislature taking power away from Roy Cooper. They took it away from Pat McCrory, who was a Republican. If Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson wins, they're likely to take more power from him somehow. What does this lack of power in the executive branch mean for North Carolina, for voters, for citizens, for our politics?
One, I think it means that it's hard to keep, it's confusing, right? I think if you ask your average person to walk down the street and say, hey, who's the most powerful politician in the state of North Carolina? They'd probably say Roy Cooper, right? They would probably say the governor. They would have said Pat McCrory when it was Pat McCrory. They would have said Bev Perdue and on and on and on. But that's not really the case, right? The most powerful politician in our state is probably Phil Berger or Tim Moore, depending on your perspective. And so I think it makes it harder for people to keep track. It means that we're not, because we've, oftentimes had different control between the governor's branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch. It means that we're not seeing as much of a check on power as that I think people tend to think that we have. So I think it leads to not disinformation in any way, but a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding from citizens about how and why their government works the way it does.
If Kamala Harris wins the election November the 5th, she will be the first female president in the history of this country. Other countries have had them for years. We're way behind the curve on that. Women remain underrepresented in Congress, in state legislatures, and elsewhere, while making up a majority of the population. And you spend time in this book looking at what greater representation of women has meant to governments and about why women may be underrepresented in non-professional legislatures, which North Carolina has, where the pay is low and the work is part-time. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, look, no matter which metric you look at, women are underrepresented in American politics and in North Carolina politics. The number tends to hover somewhere between 20 and 25%. And so, first, you might say, well, does that matter? And my answer is an unequivocal yes. We know that legislative bodies, the political bodies in general, tend to function differently and, yes, function better when they have a diversity of voices across gender lines. We also know that women tend to trust government more when they're represented, not surprisingly, by more women, right? So this has real impact regardless of whether you're a Democrat or you're a Republican. I used to hope, I used to dream, I used to think that maybe if we're just kind of patient, this thing will work its way out, right? Maybe like city councils and county commissions are really diverse. And if we just wait over time, this is, we're going to get better. And what I've seen, the more I've looked at the data, is that's not the case. That county commissions, for example, have about the same rate of female representation as our congressional delegation, our legislative delegations do. It's not just a matter of waiting for it to trickle up to the higher offices. So why is it worse maybe in a state like North Carolina? I think there's two things at play. One is what you mentioned, the professionalism or lack thereof. We pay our legislators $13,951 a year, not exactly, plus $104 per day. Not exactly. I'm currently staying in the Triangle, and I'll be honest, can't really find a hotel here for $104 a day, right? It's a money losing proposition. And so we know that in more professional legislatures, you tend to get more female representation. And the other thing at play here is we used to have Democrats and Republicans in the 80s had about the same amount of female representation in our General Assembly. In other words, if you said which party is electing more women, the answer was, yeah, it kind of it's even. Well, today it's really a stark and growing contrast. So as the Republicans have gained power in our state, again, for good or ill, you can decide, we've seen less representation among that delegation from women. So as the Republican numbers have increased, the female representation numbers in the Republican Party have decreased. So we've got a real problem in our state if you care about female representation. And again, you should.
While there is more diversity among Democrats, is there more diversity because there has always been that diversity, or has that diversity increased among Democrats as it has decreased among Republicans? And if so, what's the impact of that?
Yeah, it is the latter unequivocally. And so I've got some data in the book that shows that it used to not be this gap, and now there is this partisan gap. And so,
Why? Why?
I think with fair, well, I think it's a few things. One, it is a pipeline problem, right? And this is what we know about female representation. Study after study after study shows that if you want to increase the number of women in office, you have to get more women to run for office. There's not as much of a sanction anymore. At the ballot box, the sanction starts beforehand. And as to why that is and why that's played out, why you're getting fewer Republican women running for office, I don't know. I think that's a good question for the Republican Party. I think I know what the answer from the Democrats would be. I don't know what the answer from the Republicans would be.
You also talk about something that we've talked about in the past on this program, the urban-rural divide. It's a situation around the country which explains a lot in our general elections for president. But we have the second most rural voters in the country after Texas, you say. I didn't know that. And we are not Georgia, as you point out, because there Atlanta dominates the state. But you say that here in North Carolina, two or even three of our big cities don't dominate the state when taken collectively. So you have to pay attention to the rural vote. Does that all ex also explain some of our reddishness?
Yeah, absolutely it does, right? I mean, the Democratic Party has been getting walloped in rural North Carolina, and that's increasing. And I think one of the keys to the story that I try to tell in the book is this is maybe more recent than we think about sometimes. So anybody listening to this program knows urban areas tend to vote Democratic, rural areas tend to vote Republican. But that wasn't true as recently as 1992, and the grayer my hair gets, the more recent that seems. We had actually the urban areas were slightly more Republican, or the urban counties were slightly more Republican than the rural counties, right? So we've now flipped that on its head. As recently as 2000, Mecklenburg County and Buncombe County, where Asheville is, both voted for George W. Bush for president. So this rural divide, this urban-rural divide, is actually fairly recent, and it absolutely explains one reason why many Republicans tend to get just over the bar. It also explains why Roy Cooper has been the exception to this rule. He loses rural North Carolina, make no mistake, but the bleeding is less for him than many other Democrats. And I think in a lot of ways, that's been his secret sauce.
Unaffiliated voters in North Carolina outnumber both Republicans and Democrats. And you say this fact is incredibly important. It shows us the voters were trying to signal something, but we weren't listening. And one reason for that is that we pay too much attention, or so much attention, to winning the next election. We don't give enough thought to what it's doing to the health of our democracy. Is that why we find ourselves in such a pickle nationally as well? We're so focused on winning the horse race and not what that is doing to democracy.
Absolutely. And there's not enough people thinking about the long-term health of democracy. Part of this is, people talk about the military-industrial complex. There's a political-industrial complex, right? There's a whole lot of people making a whole lot of money on the outcome of the next election. Nobody's making much money at all thinking about the health of democracy 20 years from now, right? So the incentives of the political class are Democrat and Republican. Are lined up around the next election. So a smart political consultant is going to say, why would I care if somebody's unaffiliated? All I care about is how they're going to vote in this next election, whether they're going to be mobilized to vote. I think if you're thinking about that makes sense, right? If you're thinking about the long-term health of democracy, though, how about the fact that you pretty much have to be a member of one of the two major parties to win an election, and fewer people are actually members of one of the two major political
Well,
parties. So you
doesn't
think we
it
have a
always
problem now?
doesn't it extend beyond just the focus on, well, it is the focus on winning, but I mean, you've got, at least in certain areas of the country, including North Carolina, the Republicans who, when they are in charge, are doing things to make it more difficult to vote. And they're doing things that are more difficult to vote for people who don't generally vote for them, which helps to keep them in power. If those people can't vote, then they win. That's damaging democracy. It damages faith in democracy. We have a whole bunch of election deniers from the last election, who are spewing lies, and they know their lies about the outcome of the election. Also damaging to democracy. Is it only coming from one side? Is the urge for power, permanent power, only coming from one side? Or does the other side also engage in that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people in power want to keep power. I mean, so let's return to our unaffiliated example here. You know, neither party. So right now, our boards of elections are three Democrats and there are two Republicans. So you get it's two and two. And the party of the governor gets the chair for each of these 100 county boards of elections. It's a big fight about that, right? The Republicans said, no, we need to be tied. The Democrats say, no, we need to keep the current system. You know what nobody said? Let's let the largest group of registered voters actually have a voice. Neither the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party said, let's bring these unaffiliated people into the process, even though that's where all the young people are. That's the largest growing. That is where people coming in from out of state are. So the one thing they can both agree on is that they should be the only two parties.
Do they win, either Democrats or Republicans, if they diminish democracy? Do they win?
I think they win more elections than they lose, right? I think.
But we'll stop voting at some point. Won't we stop voting at some point? I mean, if we know that it's all predetermined, if we know that it's rigged in terms of not miscounting the votes, but that no matter how we vote, they're going to win, they being whichever side.
Right.
Isn't that going to end interest in elections? And so, yeah, if you're in, you're in forever.
You know, we haven't seen that, right? So if you buy the argument that it is getting worse, well, we also had the highest voter turnout that we've seen in over 100 years in the 2020 election. So while these things are happening, people are still engaged in the political process. They are still voting. They're arguably voting, not even arguably, they are voting at higher rates than they have voted before. So I don't think that's a clean cause and effect. What I hope we can do is to get folks, again, to think about these local elections, state elections more, where they do have more voice.
You have some prescriptions for reforms of this in North Carolina. And some of the things that you mentioned, some of the suggested fixes are eliminating the literacy test, which I didn't know we even had. It's still in the Constitution and it was there from Jim Crow. Although we don't exercise it, it's there. And I guess there are some ramifications to that. You also suggest professionalizing the legislature, which we touched on earlier in this conversation, eliminating off-year elections, and dealing with the gerrymandering. Which one would you like to talk about in the short time we have available?
Maybe I'll grab the off-year election piece because it's probably the one that folks don't think about as much, right? So
Okay. We
run a whole lot of elections here in North Carolina in these off years, right, in odd years. And so what we're getting are smaller and smaller electorates. We're getting fewer and fewer people weighing in on these positions that are closer to us. And so that's one reason you're getting these kind of wacky election results locally. They also cost a whole lot of money to run. Every time you run a local election, it costs more money than just putting them on the on-cycle election. So I think if, regardless of whether you're Democrat or Republican, if you think higher voter turnout, generally better, more representative and responsive institutions, generally better, spending less money, generally better, then it's kind of a no-brainer reform.
So we have 2 minutes. I do want to talk about gerrymandering. Both parties have used it. It's the opposite of democracy. It allows politicians to choose their voters instead of the other way around. It diminishes the power of democracy. It increases voter frustration and distrust in and dissatisfaction with our democracy. One way out, you say, is setting up independent redistricting commissions. This has happened in other states. What has been the result in those states?
Yeah, the result, first of all, we should say, just because you call it an independent redistricting commission doesn't mean it's one, right? You can put one in place and say the party in power gets to choose the members. That ain't anybody's idea of true independence. But if you get a true independent redistricting commission, you see more competitive elections, you see more compact districts, and you see more responsive governments. It's not perfect, it's not a cure-all, but it is possible and it is better than the current system we have. I think study after study is showing this. The good news is that we're now getting enough years and enough cycles of these independent redistricting commissions that we can do real analysis, and it's a good thing.
In the 30 seconds or so that I have left, aside from considering or adopting some of the solutions that you offer in this book, what do you hope readers will take away from this?
That state politics is where the action is, that North Carolina politics is a competitive state, and that competitiveness is exactly what is the thing that makes us so no holds barred. And so pay attention to the state politics. Spend a little bit less time thinking about Madison Cawthorn. Spend a little bit more time thinking about Bill Berger.
So this is the current school of thought on how we got here, why we are what we are, and how we can fix some of the things that we are. It's called Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer by Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.